8, we studied last night chapter 7, which very closely paralleled in its content, although the symbolism was different, it very closely paralleled what we saw in Daniel chapter 2, talking about the four Gentile empires that were going to eventually fall, and God's kingdom would prevail. And as we've talked several times, those four Gentile empires that Daniel prophesied about were the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and finally the Roman Empire. And the handout we had from last night, there are a few more handouts of the overall outline and the one from last night. So if there's anyone here that hasn't been with us and would like one, maybe Lowell would be kind enough, if you wanted to signal him, to see that you get one or both of those, whichever you need. Now, what the prophecies about the four empires really have been so far, and again, that's primarily chapters 2 and 7, has been what's going to happen to these pagan empires. But now when we get down to chapter 8 and through the rest of the book, the focus is not simply what's going to happen to these empires. The focus really shifts, in my opinion, to how is this going to affect God's people. And in chapter 8, as we began last night, Daniel's vision narrows down to two of those four. It narrows down to the Medo-Persian and the Greek. And the reason I believe it narrows down is, number one, by this time the Babylonian Empire had pretty much run its course, so there wasn't any real need to talk about it. The Medo-Persian and the Greek were just beginning to line up, and I believe God probably didn't talk about the Roman Empire in the book of Daniel because he knew he was going to talk about that in the book of Revelation. So that's why the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation fit so tightly together, because there are these four dominant world empires. Daniel focuses on the first three, and then John, in starting with Revelation 6 through about Revelation 17, focuses almost exclusively on the Roman Empire and the Papal Roman Empire. That's not part of our study per se. We did see in chapter 7 that the little horn rose out of the Roman Empire, and we indicated that that was symbolic of the papal system or the Pope. But now we're really not going to deal much with that again in the book of Daniel. We saw a little horn rising out of the Greek Empire, and we were just beginning to talk about who that was, and we'll go back and pick that up. There was one comment I wanted to make on verse 4 before we go on in verse 8. Chapter 8, verse 4. I didn't make this comment, but I think it's an important comment. I want to read verse 4, but it's the last phrase that I'm really after. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But notice this. But he, this is the empire and the king over it, he did according to his will and became great. God used these empires at various stages to show his displeasure and to punish his people. But never did he make these empires do what they did. These empires and the leaders of these empires always had free will. Now, this is a hard concept for us to grasp. God knows what you and I are going to do, but he doesn't cause us to do it. And if you have a little trouble grasping how someone could know what's going to happen but not cause it to happen, welcome to the club. That's just one of the many big gaps between your mind, my mind, and God's mind. God knows who's going to be saved. God knows right now whether you're going to be saved or not, but he doesn't cause you to be saved. That may be the greatest example of the sovereignty of God. God is not only so sovereign that he knows what's going to happen, he is so sovereign or all-powerful that he can know it and not cause it to happen. Now, throughout the Bible, many times I believe God uses what's called his foreknowledge or his ability to know the future, and then he will select people or nations based upon what he knows they're going to do and then uses that to exercise his will. He knew that Nebuchadnezzar was going to be a tyrant, Therefore, he used that and the Babylonian power to punish the children of Israel and take them captive. God knew Pharaoh was going to be a stubborn Pharaoh and would harden his heart. God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart, but God knew it was going to be hardened, and he used that characteristic to his purpose. And that's exactly what's happening here. But I wanted to point out that even though God's providential hand is over all of this, let's not lose sight of the sovereignty of God that allows him to know and utilize characteristics that are in us, but not cause those characteristics to happen. Otherwise, it would be God determining who is going to be saved, and man would have no part in it. And I talked about that last Wednesday night at Dean Avenue, and I don't mean to go through it again, but I just think that phrase is there for a purpose. He did according to his will, not according to God's will. God utilized that, but it was that man and that nation's and that empire's decision to do that. Okay, we also talked about that when we see in verse 9 this little horn coming out of this empire, and here it's coming out of the Greek Empire. This is different from the little horn that we saw in chapter 7, because in chapter 7 the little horn was coming out of the Roman Empire. Here it's coming out of the Greek Empire. So it's two similarities, but they're two different entities. The one that comes out of the Roman Empire in chapter 7 and in the book of Revelation is the papal system or the apostate church. The one that we see coming out here in chapter 8 will be the one that chapter 11 will be almost exclusively dedicated to. And this is the 8th Syrian or Seleucid king, in particular Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay? And that's about where we got to last night, and I thought that might be where we would start. But before I start with new material, let me pause and see if you've got any questions up till now or on anything I've said tonight, and then we'll proceed on. I think we've paced ourselves well so that I won't have to rush through the last half of chapter 9, and that's my real intent, because that's such a pivotal prophecy. Okay, look at chapter 11. You remember, I can't remember, I'm sorry, verse 11, chapter 8. I knew when I heard pages turning something was wrong. Chapter 8, verse 11. You remember Monday or Tuesday night when I talked a little bit about millennialism and the different concepts of whether the kingdom was physical or spiritual? Well, the premillennialists, which are probably the dominant belief in the Protestant community today. It goes in cycles. Postmillennialism was the dominant one back before World War I, but now probably premillennialism is. And premillennialists believe that when Jesus comes back, he will set up his earthly kingdom and will reign here on earth in that kingdom for 1,000 years. And a premillennialist would look at the kingdom as it's described in Daniel and equate almost all of that to a future kingdom that's going to come when Jesus comes back. But let me point out to you in verse 11 how I believe that cannot be what he's talking about. In verse 11 it says, "And he magnified himself even against, as some translations say, the prince of the host," that would be the priests of the temple, "and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down." Now that daily sacrifice were the sacrifices that the Jews offered in the temple. And the sanctuary there is the temple. So whatever he's talking about in verse 11 can't be in the future. I believe it has to have been, at least in the Jewish dispensation, because we know once Christ was nailed to the cross, the animal sacrifices were done away with. The temple doesn't even exist. Now, a lot of premillennialists, in order to get around this, are hanging their hats on the temple in Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt. And you'll hear a lot of talk and TV shows about how the temple is going to be rebuilt. I don't see how in the world that's going to happen, because the Arabs have their chief mosque, I think it's called the Rock, isn't it? Right there where the temple was. So if the Jews or anyone ever tried to build a temple there,
World War III would probably break out. But even if that's not true, it makes absolutely no sense because the Jews don't know who the Levites are anymore. When Titus came in and destroyed the temple in 70 AD, all of the Jewish records were destroyed. So Jews today know whether they're Jews, but they don't know which tribe they are. Now, I don't know what you're going to do with a temple if you don't have any Levites to be priests and offer the sacrifices. It just falls apart. And I wanted to make that point. But verse 11 clearly to me indicates that we're talking about something that was going to happen before the Jewish dispensation ended. Otherwise, there would be no daily sacrifices. There would be no temple for which this to apply to. Okay. Let me just read a few verses and then we'll go on. Verse 12, "And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered." In other words, these daily sacrifices are going to end. Something's going to happen, and the Jews are not going to be able to sacrifice their daily sacrifices. So we've got to go into history and find out when that was. Verse 13, "And I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto a certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" In other words, how long is our temple worship going to be disrupted? And then in verse 14, we have a pretty famous verse in Daniel's prophecy, and I want to explain my understanding of it. The answer to how long the temple was going to be desolate was 2,300 days. Now, if you have the King James Version, you may have a center margin that says 2,300 mornings and evenings. And that is the correct translation. The Hebrew word for days is yom, Y-O-M. And the word in this verse is not yom. This literally should be translated 2,300 or 2,300 evenings and mornings. And I believe the Holy Scriptures did that on purpose so that we wouldn't confuse it with this day-year concept. This is literally talking about 2,300 mornings and evenings, or days as we see it. Now, if you do the math, 2,300 days on a 360-day-a-year calendar comes to something like 6 years, 4 months, and 20 days. Now, last night I told you about Antiochus Epiphanes, how that he went down and began to, or tried to fight against the Egyptians, and he was frustrated. I don't think I added this point, but it's kind of interesting. And you've got to understand the egomaniacs that we've got involved with. Antiochus was going down to fight the Ptolemies in Egypt. And Rome heard about this and didn't want it to happen. So Rome dispatched one of their generals to Egypt to intercept Antiochus Epiphanes. And you can just see him coming, Epiphanes coming down with his army, and here's this. It wasn't an army, it was just one Roman general. And he stood in front of him, in front of all of his men, and said, "Don't do it." And then, as history records it, Antiochus says, "I'll think about it." And the Roman general then drew a circle around him in the dirt and said, "Well, make up your mind before you leave that circle." And it just really humiliated this man. He knew he couldn't go against the Roman powers of that day, and he went back. And it was on his way back that he took out his frustrations on Jerusalem. And this would take us to about 171 A.D. when Antiochus went back from Egypt, heading towards Syria. He takes out his frustration on Jerusalem, and that began the desecration. I want to take just a second and read just a little bit from Josephus that I mentioned last night, not to put you to sleep, but just to give you a little flavor. This is in the Antiquities of the Jews, Book 12, Chapter 5, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. What did I say? 171? B.C. Yeah, B.C. Thank you, Lowell. Yes, this is all B.C. at this point. "Now Antiochus, upon agreeable situation of the affairs of his kingdom, resolved to make an expedition against Egypt because he had a desire to gain it. That's just what I tried to tell you in my words. And I'm going to skip over here, but I'll just pick a few verses. Now, King Antiochus, returning out of Egypt for fear of the Romans, made an expedition against the city of Jerusalem, and he was there in the 170th year of the kingdom of the Seleucids. He took the city without fighting. Jerusalem was no match for him. And the king, coming up to Jerusalem, pretending to be peaceful, he got possession of the city by treachery, at which time he spared not so much as that which admitted unto him on account of the riches. And led by his covetous inclinations, he saw that there was a great deal of gold there. So he looted the temple, just like Nebuchadnezzar had done in 586 B.C. Drop down a little bit further. And when he had pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive together with their wives and children, so that the multitude of these captives were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. He also burnt the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was high, which he overlooked. Then it talks about the religion. He compelled them to forsake the worship which they had paid their own God, and to adore those whom he had raised idols altar. In fact, he placed a Syrian idol in the holy of holy places of the temple, which was just anathema to the Jews. He went on and caused swine to be sacrificed on the idol in the temple, and we talked about what a irritating thing that would be to the Jews. He forbade the Jews to be circumcised during this period. It was just a really terrible time for the Jews. And this period of the desolation of the temple began in 171 B.C. and went to 165 B.C., at which time the Maccabees, which was a family name, and Judas Maccabee, of which you may have heard and I touched on last night, led a successful revolt against the Syrians and took back the temple. And there was great rejoicing, so much rejoicing that, as I mentioned, in the Gospel of John, when Jesus went to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Dedication, that's what that feast was all about. It was a feast the Jews had to commemorate the rededication of the temple and the getting it back. And that's what we find occurring in here. And this 2300 days fits just perfectly with the amount of time from when the temple was desecrated until when the Maccabees took it back. And I believe that's what it's referring to. Just a couple of other comments here in verse 8 from me. In verse 23, we see a phrase about halfway through, the king of fierce countenance. That's again a reference to Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I didn't read these verses, but you might just note that verses 20 and 21 explain the interpretation that was in the early part of this chapter. I just gave you the interpretation as we went through it. But again, you can reference verses 20. It says that the ram with two horns was Medo-Persia, and the goat was Greece. Down in the last part of verse 25, the Prince of Princes is a reference to God. And notice, it says that Antiochus will be broken without hand. In the end of verse 25, that means that he would be brought down, but not simply by the strength of men. He would be brought down by God. When something's done without hand, that indicates it's done by the supernatural power. And so God's hand in bringing this man down. The Maccabees could have in no way defeated them had God not been behind that and given them the courage. It's almost like the story in the Old Testament where they took 300 men out to slay the Midianites, I believe. You know, there's just no way that can happen. Well, God does it that way so that when it does happen, any logical thinking man knows it can't happen, so you got to give the glory to God. That's what it's all about. That's that whole story of David and Goliath. You know, that can't happen but for the power of God, and on and on and on, examples of that. And that's what we have, I believe, appearing here. Verse 16, let me just back up. I did miss this. There is a mention to the angel Gabriel. There are only two angels mentioned in the Bible by name, Gabriel and Michael. And Gabriel happens to be the one that comes to Daniel. Gabriel, you'll also will be the one that will come and announce John the Baptist and the coming of the Messiah. So Gabriel was not an archangel as far as we know. Michael was, according to the book of Jude. But Gabriel apparently was a very active angel to an extent that he's one of the two mentioned, and probably mentioned even more than Michael. Verse 26, Daniel is asked to keep this to himself for a period of time. And the vision of the evening and morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision. Keep it secret. Now, he wrote it down for us later. But this was not one that was published, apparently, at this time. I can't tell you how long. It says it shall be secret for many days. I don't know how long that is, but there was a reason that they didn't want this out. And notice what effect this had on Daniel. And Daniel fainted and was sick. And afterward I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Why do you think Daniel was sick? Why would this make Daniel sick? A very emotional experience, no question about that. Why else might this make Daniel sick? We don't know. I'm speculating. That's a right. Yeah, here he's been told what's going to happen to his people. And that's a very troubling thing. Probably one of God's greatest blessings he gives us is we don't know how we're going to die and we don't know what's going to happen to our family. I don't want to know. I don't think you do either. Daniel was told what was going to happen to his people, and it made him sick. Really, really was an emotionally wrung out. And we're going to see this concept several times. Okay, any questions on chapter 8 before we turn to chapter 9?
Verse 26 was on your idea of the evening and the morning.
Yes, yes, thank you. I think that was a large part of it. Yeah, what she said is that may be the reason that in chapter 9 we see a very lengthy prayer. The first 19 verses, or verses 3 through 19 anyway, are a prayer. One of the most beautiful prayers. I'm going to a little bit apologize to you that we're not going to do that prayer justice, because I think you can go and read it and revel in it and glean that for yourselves. But don't just brush over the first 19 verses of Daniel in anxiousness to get to the 70 weeks prophecy, even though that's what I'm going to do tonight. Don't you do it. You go back and read that prayer, because it's a wonderful prayer. Let me.
At the end of verse 17, we're talking about the vision will take place at the end of time.
Yes.
At the end of 2300 days.
Let me make sure I've got that. Falling his face and understand, O son. It would be at the end of those 23 days. I think the reference there to the end of time was more of a reference to the end of the Jewish dispensation. And the end of that would have been near the end of the Jewish dispensation. Good point. Sometimes in the Bible, when it says end of time, it's not talking about the judgment day as we see it. It's the end of that time, which this time would have been the Jewish dispensation. Yes. And the reason I don't think it's the end of time is, if it were the end of time, you wouldn't have the daily sacrifices in the temple to worry about. Same argument I used earlier. This had to have occurred when those things were in place. So I think that's the end of the Jewish dispensation. Anybody else? Okay, I want to make a couple of comments on the first two verses in chapter 9. Number one, the Ahasuerus you see there is not the same one that was Esther's husband. This is probably 70 to 80 years before Esther. Okay, Esther probably took place in about 475 B.C., and we're still at about 537 or 536. Okay, and the book of Esther took about 10 years to cover. So it occurred between the first return under Zerubbabel and the second return under Ezra. But that's another study, but that's not the same one. Notice in verse 2, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understand by books the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. Now that verse is interesting for two or three reasons. Number one, it tells us that Daniel had access to what we call the book of Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah and Daniel were somewhat contemporary, although Jeremiah would have probably been 20 or 30 years older than Daniel. I suspect they knew each other. And Daniel had access to the books of Jeremiah. And in the book of Jeremiah, and I won't turn and read them, but you can note these, or I don't know if I put them in this handout or not. I didn't. In Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 10 through 12, and Jeremiah 29, verses 10 through 12, Jeremiah says that the children of Israel are going to be captive for 70 years. And Daniel had access to that document, so Daniel apparently knew that the captivity was going to last 70 years. Now, what he didn't know was when God started counting those 70 years. He couldn't be for sure there, but he had to know that he'd been there 70 years, so it had to be getting near the end. So that, in addition to what Jeannie said, I think really sets the tone for this prayer. Daniel was a tremendous Bible student. And this certainly proves it. Okay? Anybody remember why 70 years? I know why they were in captivity, because they were disobedient. But why for 70 years? Anybody remember? Well, there was a rule that was given to them in Leviticus that every seventh year would be a Sabbath year and the land would rest. And the Jews had abandoned that. And for 490 years, the Jews did not let the land rest every 7 years. So what do you think God did? God said, you owe me 70 years, I'll take it. I'll just take you into captivity. The land got its 70 years rest because the Jews hadn't done that for 490 years. And I've got to put this on the board, for me anyway. One of the beauties of the book of Daniel is symmetry. 490 years... that the Sabbaths were not done. 70 years of captivity. And then in the last part of the book of Daniel, you have 400 years of prophecy into the future.
Now you tell me God doesn't have this thing all figured out. Exactly what happened is, God knew when Christ was going to come. He sent the Jews into captivity so their captivity would end, or not quite, but around this period of time. And they were paying for 490 years. And it's a good way to remember it. You've got this beautiful symmetry, two 490s and a 70 in between. And you know how long the Jews forsook the Sabbath year. And how long they were in captivity, and how long the prophecy lasts in the last part of the book of Daniel. Okay. Those of you that want a reference on that, why they were in captivity, it's 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20 and 21. Any comments or questions so far? Okay. A couple of observations in Daniel's prayer, and I just hate to skip anything, but we have to a little bit. Notice in verse 4, I prayed unto the Lord my God and made my confession. My confession. Verse 5, we have sinned. Had Daniel done anything wrong? Not at all. He may have been about the only one that hadn't, but he felt such empathy for his people that it was as if he had done it. So he says, my confession, we have sinned. A great attitude. None of this, God, I know everyone's messed up, but have mercy on us. That wasn't his attitude at all. His attitude is, we have sinned. Listen to my petition. Okay, let's drop down to verse 20 of chapter 9, with your permission. Verse 20, Daniel now says, and while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin, still my sin and the sin of my people, and presenting my supplication before the Lord, my God, for the holy mountain of my God, the holy mountain, reference to Jerusalem. Yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, reappearance of Gabriel the angel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly,
touched me about the time of the evening oblation or the evening prayer. And the Jews had three times of daily prayer, 9 a.m, noon, and 3 p.m. So this would have been the 3 p.m., if you will, prayer session. Terribly disciplined man. And the Jews were disciplined, and I have to give them an applaudit for that. They just would pray at those times. Verse 22, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give you skill and understanding. Gabriel has come to help Daniel understand some of these things. And at the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment cometh forth, and I came to show you, for thou art greatly beloved, that would be by God, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. Now verse 24 is a summary of this prophecy, and then verses 25 through 27 are some specifics. So let's read the summary first. Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon the holy city, or Jerusalem, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. In this 70 weeks, at some point, all of these things were going to happen. There would be a finish to transgression, there would be an end to sin, and a reconciliation for sin. Now we have to understand that what he's describing there is the plan of salvation. Until Jesus died on the cross, no sin could be washed away. No animal sacrifice could take away the sin. Now, it was like the Jews put their sins on a charge account, but it wasn't paid until Christ died on the cross. That's why in Hebrews chapter 9, Paul says he died not simply for us and for those in the future, he died for those in the past. Okay. Had Jesus not died on the cross, Abraham, Moses, Daniel would have been lost just like you and I, because his blood washed forwards and backwards, if you will. So what he's describing there is the plan of salvation, a reconciliation. It doesn't mean that sin quit being sin. It just meant there was a way now to get rid of it. There's no reason to have sin on your life once this event occurs. And I believe that's what he's talking about. Okay, let's go a little bit further here and read verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore the temple of Israel unto the Messiah. So we're talking about some time frame that begins when God commands them to rebuild Jerusalem and takes us up to at least the Messiah. The prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So we've got a timeline here that in totality is going to be 70 weeks. Now, 70 weeks, remember, 70 weeks is 490 days. And we talked about the prophetic use of the day for the year. So we're talking about 490 days. Or 490 years in prophecy. And that day-year concept is crucial to understanding Daniel and Revelation. So we've got a 490-year span here with which this is going to happen. Now, it says that 69 of these weeks, which would be 483 years, is going to take us from when Jerusalem, the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, to the Messiah. Okay? Now the key to understanding this for me is, when's this date? When does this start? It's easy to do the math, but when does it start? Well, you might keep your finger in the book of Daniel, and let's go back to the book of Ezra and look at a couple of possibilities. In Ezra chapter 1, there's one possibility. Ezra In verse 2 of Ezra chapter 1, it says, "Thus saith Cyrus king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged or decreed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judea." That's one possibility. The difficulty I have with that is not a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, that's a decree to rebuild the temple. So I don't think that's it. Now, if you and I were going back to Jerusalem, we'd build the city or the wall and then the temple last. But that's not the way God looked at it. He wanted the temple built first. And in fact, it was built quite some time. Another possibility is in Ezra chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6, verse 3. "The first year of Cyrus, the same Cyrus, the king, made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem." Here's a decree to go back and rebuild, but again, it's to rebuild the temple. So I don't think that one fits. Chapter 7, and about verse 13. This was from Artaxerxes, the king. "I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and of his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go." And then he goes on and talks about the carrying of silver in verse 15. If you look at verse 20, "Whatsoever more shall be needful for" what? "The house of thy God." Again, it's talking about rebuilding the temple. Now, some of you utilize Brother Zur's commentaries, and this is the one he hones in on his understanding. And he would consider Ezra chapter 7 to be the beginning of it. I don't personally think that's quite it, but he and I aren't off by too much. The one that I think this has reference to is in Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 1. Nehemiah chapter 2. Well, yeah, chapter 2, really, let's drop down to verse 5. Here, Nehemiah has asked for permission to go back, and he says in verse 5, "If it please the king, and if thy servant has found favor in thy sight, send me to Judea, to the city of my fathers, that I may build it." Here's the request to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, and it is granted here, and Nehemiah goes back and begins the building. So I personally think that Nehemiah chapter 2 is the best starting place for this time sequence. Now, I've got a handout, and if Lowell and Larry would help me, just a single page that has some of this on it, but I wanted to walk through it before I pass that out, because you'd just be looking at that. And we'll begin putting some dates on this. Now, you can find reference points that lead you any which direction on dates, pretty much, but the ones I found the most reliable at least lead me to this conclusion. An excellent commentary on this chapter, if you want to do some reading on it, is Albert Barnes' commentary. It's not the only good one, but it's a good one. He spends about 40 pages talking about these three verses. I'll spare you that. But as you get that handout, you can begin to see that we're going to begin to put some dates in here. You can find dates all the way from 445 to 455, probably, on Nehemiah chapter 2. I personally believe, and some of the more recent findings support 455, as opposed to 445, but if you've got some older reference material, you won't have any trouble finding 445. It's just that they thought one of these kings ruled for 20 years, and come to find out he didn't. And it moves everything up about 10 years. Thank you, guys. So the beginning of this 490-year or 70-week span is 455 B.C. And it says, at the end of 69 weeks, according to Daniel, let's go back to the book of Daniel now, verse 26, after 25, I'm sorry. Know therefore and understand that what goeth forth from the commandment to restore the temple, that's 455 B.C., unto the Messiah shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, or 69 weeks. There's the 7 weeks and then the 62 weeks, or 69 weeks. So we've got 483 years. And that takes you up to 29 A.D. Now in this prophecy, we have one final week, which would take us up to 36 A.D., if our concept is right, that a day is a year and a week would then account for 7 years. Everybody follow that? Okay, it's not hard, but people make it hard. But if you don't, please ask or catch me afterwards. Okay? Now, let's go back to Daniel. Now, after this, so we've got a 7 week period here, and then a 62 week period here, which together make this 69 weeks that I've just lumped together. Then in chapter 20, or verse 26, it says, after this 62-week period, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be the end. And he shall, verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. Now that's talking about in the middle of this last week, sacrifices are going to cease. Now when did the Jewish sacrifices cease religiously? When Christ was put on the cross. So verse 27 says he's going to confirm this covenant, this new covenant, for this week. But in the middle of that week, which would be right here, you got the cross. Because that's when the sacrifice has ceased, spiritually. Remember Hebrews chapter 10 says, he died once for all. No more sacrifice was needed. Okay? If this is in the middle of this week, this becomes 32 and a half, if you will. Or 32, not a half. Yeah, and a half. A.D. And gives Christ a ministry of about 3.5 years, which our chronology on the New Testament confirms. Okay? Now there's one mathematical question mark about what I've put up there, and I wondered if someone would ask it, but you haven't. One of the things, if you watched real carefully, is that if you take 455 and this 483, let's just take 483 and subtract 455 from it, what do you get? You get 28. And I put 29 up there. Okay? But 29 is correct, and let me tell you why. This math does not apply when you're going from BC to AD. And the reason it doesn't, the reason it doesn't apply is there is no 0 year. Okay? There was no 0 year. So, as the calendars were put together, if this was the timeline, and let's say this was 5 BC, 4 BC, 3 BC, 2 BC, 1 BC, the next year is not zero. The next year is 1 AD, 2 AD. So, this math would want us to go to zero, but there is no zero. So we've got to push ourselves one more year down the road, and that takes us to 29 rather than 28 AD. So in anticipation of someone catching that after I left town, I've probably got mistakes, but let that not be one of them. Okay? Now, there's a couple of other questions that can come up. For instance, what year was Jesus born? Probably 4 or 5 B.C. It wasn't 0 or 1. It's probably 4 or 5 B.C. because he was born while Herod the Great was in power, and he died in 4 B.C. So Jesus was probably born in around 4 or 5 B.C. So if he started his ministry in 29 A.D. and started, let's say, and was born even in 4, how old would he have been when he started his ministry? That's not fair, is it? 32 or so. And we normally think Jesus began his ministry when he was 30. But if you turn to Luke chapter 23, chapter 3, verse 23, where we normally get the concept that he began his ministry at 30, it says, and he was about the age of 30. So I don't have any problem that Jesus may have been 32 when he began his ministry. The Bible doesn't say he was 30. It says he was about 30. And he was probably past the age of 30 because that's when the priests would normally begin their priesthood. But it's awful easy for us to just think, well, it was 30 because it's always been 30. But you read that.